Hi, Dr. Trzaskowski. I wanted to ask you a question about how you feel the Ontario rental housing reforms introduced by Premier Mike Harris in 1998 will impact on the affordability of housing in this province and also the crisis of homelessness in this province over the next 10 years, or just sort of with the reform. Basically, when I refer to reform, I'm talking mostly about the removal of rent control. That's it.
Well, I think the answer is pretty clear. It will lead to a situation of speculation in the housing market. It will eventually mean that certain categories of people who are low income will not be able to afford the type of decent housing which may be insured under a system of rent control. I think it's part of the process of deregulation which is affecting other areas such as health and education.
Okay.
Mic two.
That's good.
Yes, I'd like to ask, who owns the largest world banks and, for that matter, Canada's chartered banks? Is it primarily individuals or is it institutional investors? And how do they benefit from the extraordinary profits that these banks are realizing?
Well, I can't really answer that question. They're stockholders. I don't know exactly who they are, but there are always majority stockholders of these banks. And then, of course, there are the senior managers within these banking institutions, which are on very, very high salaries. And then there's also a lot of stocks which are purchased just by the general public. And that may vary from one institution to another. I think that within those financial institutions, you also have some very large private fortunes, but it's not always easy to find out who owns the stock of these banks. You can be more categorical, let's say, if you look at some of the private companies like Fidelity Investments, which is one of the largest mutual funds in the world, which is owned by one family. Okay, it's a private company with a net worth of I think it's something of the order of $20-30 billion. So again, I think that behind these financial institutions, you have large amounts of private wealth.
I wonder how many people of my generation remember the British Empire, the history of the British Empire, the colonialism that took place during the British Empire, the building of the British Empire, and the difficulties that Mahatma Gandhi and Nehru had in striving to divest themselves of that colonialism. Are we in the same predicament now under globalization and our future is similar to that of these people that fought against colonialism? We're fooling ourselves with democracy, but here we're merging into a colonial empire. Thank you.
I think in many regards, this is a process of recolonization. It is a process of recolonization in countries which in the post-war period had asserted a certain level of independence and autonomy, and through macroeconomic manipulation. It's a form of financial warfare where you can come in and simply take over the resources of that country, the institutions, the labor, and through a market mechanism, you don't actually need to invade the country, you don't even need to establish a colonial administration. But ultimately, you set the conditions for that country. You set very tight conditions, and you establish an administration which is ultimately controlled by Western capital. I just give you an example. Uh, in in the Dayton Agreements, which led to the formation of Bosnia-Herzegovina. And Bosnia-Herzegovina is a colonial, is a colony, in the strictest sense of the word, it's a colony. The Constitution was written in a U.S. military air force base by Western lawyers and consultants, and in the Bosnian Constitution, which is an appendix to the document of the agreement, which was not even ratified by citizens in the country, it is stipulated that the president of the Central Bank of Bosnia-Herzegovina will be appointed by the IMF, and the president of the Bank of Bosnia-Herzegovina will not be a citizen of Bosnia-Herzegovina. Okay? And then it also says the bank will not be allowed to operate as a central bank, but must operate as a currency board. And the currency board solution is being proposed in a number of countries. That is a colonial, it's a colonial monetary system. It requires full foreign exchange backing, and it simply paralyzes the state in financing its own economic development. Another thing which is very much reminiscent of the colonial period is the, you might recall that in the British, in India, but it was also applied in other parts of the British Empire, they had what was called an internal transit duty. Britain imposed free trade, but then had an internal transit duty on goods which were produced in the country going from one region to another. In other words, with the purpose of blocking producers off from their own market. And that was the basis on which ultimately the British were able to flood the Indian market and destroy its manufacturing base, because they had an internal tariff on domestically produced commodities. Now, what the World Bank does today is very similar, is that they order the hikes in fuel prices. And the price of fuel in developing countries is always about three times that in the United States, which acts as a tax, a tariff, on domestically produced commodities for the domestic market, which cannot or no longer compete with goods which are imported under a regime of free trade. Those are some of the examples on how you manipulate and you establish colonial rule on a country. Credit. In Vietnam, for instance, credit is something like 33 to 38% per annum in a non-inflationary environment. So evidently, local enterprises, how can they compete? They have to pay their gas three times the price of the United States, and then the credit is at 33 to 38%. And under those conditions, if bankruptcy is not ordered in at the outset, it is ultimately built in to the measures which are imposed as a result of these adjustment programs.
In this dismal picture, there is a window of opportunity until midnight tomorrow night. There are a group of dedicated people working to abolish NAFTA and go back to GATT, where we won disputes, to stop Canada from being Americanized, to go for a financial transaction tax and proportional representation, and it's called David Orchard. And I'm an NDP member, but I thought it was the best $10 I ever spent to get someone in a leadership position that would turn the country around. I brought with me two forms. If you have $10 or a check, we can register you tonight. If you didn't, I'm sorry, News World yesterday.
Okay.
My question is, are you not afraid of censorship? CBC News World decided yesterday not to cover the all candidates debate. Hugh Siegel and Clark pulled out last week, so Toronto didn't have a debate. If you want to sign up tonight, we can do it in the lobby. Thank you.
Yeah, it wasn't a question, so I don't really need to provide an answer. But let me just say one thing. I think that we are here with different views and different perspectives. I think the $10 revolution is something which we have to respect for those who want to do it. And I think it's a worthwhile objective. But there are different ways to wage this battle. And I at least that's the way I feel. Okay?
This man doesn't need a moderator. He's his own moderator.
Okay.
But I will go to microphone one now.
Good evening. I'd like to ask you, we're talking here about marginalized economies and marginalized countries. I'd like to bring that out to you that the United States of America is probably one of the most marginalized countries in the world for the simple fact that most of their industry is owned by foreigners. They don't care who they sell their shares to. They put them out on the market, and anyone who's got the money will buy them. And the problem with Canada, as I see it, is we followed their example. We've opened up our markets to them, and we follow their ways. So we're saying, anyone that comes here to this country, just bring your money. We don't care who you are. Just bring the money. We'll take it. What I'm getting at is the American government has invited any country or any speculator or anyone who has a buck to bring it to the U.S. So there, too, one day, people who own the shares will call in their chips. The American government and the American way will crumble just the way the socialist communist government has crumbled due to the fact of the American intervention breaking down the communist systems that were reasonably stable, and now they've moved in like the vulture that they are to take in the kill. Thanks.
I don't know what the question was, so...
Well, you don't have that.
Yeah. Okay, there was. Yeah.
Microphone number two.
What do you recommend we do to mobilize the level of awareness needed to save what is being taken away from us, the sleeping masses?
Okay. Well, this is a very important question. It's a very difficult question because I think that society is totally disarmed in this struggle. Okay, we have to rebuild social movements. We see that the leftist parties don't provide any avenue for the development of those social movements. We also see that the trade unions up to a point don't offer those avenues, although that's not to say that they can't be democratized and shaped in another direction. But I think we have to start by extending our understanding of what is happening to the broad sectors of public opinion. Not an easy task, because the media is controlled by a handful of large conglomerates. The information which is fed to us is distorted, people have to understand what is the source of their impoverishment. Why are they losing their jobs? Why is their income going down? Why are social services no longer available? It is not... They have been provided that explanation, but that explanation is based on a falsehood. We have to break that falsehood. We have to break that false consciousness.
There is no room in globalization for unions.
Okay, I guess I answered the question. Thank you.
Number three.
Yeah.
Thank you. Professor Chostovsky, if I may, I'd like to take advantage also of Thomas Wacom hasn't had a chance to say anything on this, and he's a member of the media. What is your opinion on what... And if I may add a sub-question to that, why is it that the media seems to have blinders on or tunnel vision with the neoconservative, neoliberal agenda, and why can't they open up the press to alternative points of view?
Sorry, was this question to me? Well, okay, look, I'm not here to be an apologist for the media. Your question was, why don't they allow alternate views of the neoliberal agenda?
But also, what is your opinion on what Professor Chostovsky is saying, and will you be able to, say, write about that in your column to be able to say, hey, this guy's got a great point of view, listen up. Maybe there's something here.
Well, my opinion, for what it's worth, which isn't a whole lot, is that I think Professor Chostovsky has a lot to say that's really good. In fact, I've, in the little bits of writing that I do on this topic, I've talked about some of the same kinds of things. You probably don't want to hear a lecture by me. Well, I'll give you one anyway. I think, in my view, this is a very serious crisis that we're in right now, this economic crisis. Like Professor Chostovsky, I think it's mistaken to view this as a problem that began with the Thais or the Indonesians or the cronies of Suharto. It's a problem of international capital, and it's a problem which relates in part to the mobility of capital. The incredible ability of short-term money to move around, to flood all over the globe, and it's to be destabilizing. I haven't spent as much time myself on the international organizations like the IMF as Professor Chostovsky has. I think, though, from the little I do know about them, and I've spent some time dealing with them over the last 10 or 15 years, what he says has a lot of truth. The IMF, which began really, is not a bad idea, probably, in terms of stabilizing. If you think stabilizing a capitalist economy is not a bad thing, that was the origin of the IMF and the World Bank. But it's become very much an international institution which acts at the behest, certainly of the major financer of the IMF, which is the United States, because they under IMF rules, the Americans call the shots, and the Americans, of course, act to a large extent at the behest of their private banks. I think that's quite true. There are divisions within the international organizations over this particular crisis. And the chief economist of the World Bank, a guy by the name of Stiglitz, for example, has been quite critical of what the IMF is doing. So it's not entirely monolithic, all of this stuff. There are some subtleties. There are some gradations. I won't go on that point. Your second question was, why doesn't the media deal with this? Well, to a certain extent, it does. I've written about this in The Star. Naomi Klein's written about this in The Star. There is some stuff. Not a whole lot. Why is that? I'm not sure it's because the Toronto Star is owned by the Atkinson family. And I'm not sure it's because the Thompsons own the Globe and Mail. And I'm not sure it's because Conrad Black owns everything else. That may be the case. That may be the case. I think also there is in Canada generally a lack of interest and understanding, not only in the press, but in the public, about what goes on in other places. Not in this body, obviously. This is about 500 people here. But among people generally. And I think, to a certain extent, that's reflected in the press. So part of it's a conspiracy. Part of it's your fault. Number four.
Good evening. I'd like to question the viewpoint that nothing can be done about to stop globalization. I remember not too long ago, the same attitude was said about the May. The media did not mention the May, did not support the opposing it, and yet a great underswell of public opposition developed via the internet when people became aware what that meant. And the same thing would happen, can happen again, if globalization, if everybody understands the simple fact that globalization means control of the world by huge international corporations rather than national states that can try and develop policies for the well-being of most of their population rather than international companies who are only interested in the increasing their bottom line at any cost. Environmental costs, labor costs, using child labor, and so on. When that becomes aware, when it's a decision between those two things, I think you can get enough public opposition aroused to stop it. Now, my question is, has to do with the fact you mentioned about the huge creation of money that's going on. It seems to me it would be appropriate if you could perhaps enlarge that. My understanding is private banks are now have the ability without any control to create as much credit money as they want. In Canada, the Canadian banks are speculating with 300 times the money of their own capital. When they speculate with such huge amounts of money they just create out of thin air, a small loss puts them into bankruptcy. Then the government comes along, and back in 1991, they arranged that in order to bail out the banks who had excessive real estate losses, they would allow them to purchase government bonds without putting up a penny of their own money. So the Canadian banks now hold $80 billion of government debt, and our government is paying them every year $5 billion as a welfare payment, completely needlessly, because our Bank of Canada could be buying those government debt and cost us no interest. Could you elaborate on that, please?
I just comment very briefly. What you're suggesting is that the commercial banks, the chartered banks, ultimately have replaced the central bank as far as the process of money creation is concerned. I mean, we know that that has always been the case up to a certain point, but we've relaxed the reserve requirements, and ultimately, it's quite true, they can just take out a checkbook and write a check. Okay? And this, I think, is also marks a very important change in the structure of capitalism, because we understood capitalism as being based on ownership of productive assets. Okay, ultimately, the ownership of physical capital and so on. But the main source of economic and financial power today is on the ability to create money. Okay, Mr. Soros doesn't really need to own anything. Okay, I mean, all he needs is to be able to write out checks, and it is that ability which is completely unregulated, because it doesn't respond to any kind of central bank regulations, that the governments are indebted to the lenders of last resort, which are the commercial banks, and not the other way around. And that, of course, that is the fundamental question, because it means that they have captured money creation. They can generate credit. They can finance whatever they want. Okay, they can, if they want to finance a dream park in Brazil or something or whatever, according to any criteria, they do it. But and okay. Well, I'll stop at that.
Okay. Number one.
Yes, I was just wondering how much longer you think the power brokers that have been prescribing all this bad medicine to so many countries can continue doing so with any credibility, given that the medicine they've been prescribing, of course, is not only bad, it's actually lethal for the countries concerned. I heard on the way down here Norman Lamont on the radio. He was the Chancellor of the Exchequer who arranged the first IMF structural adjustment plan for Russia in 1992. And his recipe was more privatization, more foreign investment, and by no means any printing of more rubles to pay the Russian workers who haven't been paid for so many months, because, of course, that's inflationary. I mean, have these people no shame? How are they able to continue peddling this in the media? And I guess a more fundamental question, how is it that they're still believed when the evidence is, that people like yourself have provided is just so mounting against them?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. The evidence is overwhelming that these economic policies are destructive. Yet, if you look at the situation country by country, the alternatives to that macroeconomic agenda are simply not unfolding. Why? Because they don't have any kind of social movements behind them. Okay, so I think it's going to be very difficult to reverse these policies without some kind of movement from below, because the political establishment in the country is under adjustment, including sections of the local capitalist class in these countries are following suit with these reforms. I spoke to people in the Korean embassy recently, and I asked them, they said that they recognize the diagnosis, that this is actually killing them, that the economic medicine is the cause of destruction, but they said we have no other choice. And my understanding is that that social movements have not made sufficient indent in swaying the policy in another direction. And that's why I said there are no technical solutions. You're not going to be able to reverse this. It's a very heavily ingrained power structure with an institutional base, with tremendous money, with high-tech facilities to transfer money. You're not simply going to reverse this by simply saying it's bad, or that. And in any event, people don't understand it because they don't have the knowledge of the impacts, or they only think that the impacts are taking in their country, but not all over the world. When I travel, I was in Albania last December, where the country has been literally devastated by macroeconomic reform. But the Albanians they don't see the international dimensions of this crisis. They don't know what is happening beyond their borders. They don't know that the IMF program has been applied in 100 other countries. And consequently, the sources of their impoverishment then becomes explained in terms of other types of circumstances. Invariably, it's inter-ethnic rivalries which result from the wake of these reforms. You might have noticed in Indonesia now, people are starting to target the ethnic Chinese. And they say it's the ethnic Chinese are responsible for our impoverishment, because they don't understand the nature of these bailouts, and they don't, in their response to the crisis, they target the government in power. Now, what happens is that the government in power is targeted. In Albania, it was the government of Sali Berisha. He was displaced. Then they brought in a new government under the socialists. It was backed by Washington, and they continue with exactly the same programs. So that each time there's dissent from society, it is the local government which is replaced, and then a successor government which adopts the neoliberal agenda is instated, continuing to do the same kind of program. So ultimately, what is ultimately required is the reformation of social movements, both nationally and internationally, to make this much more of a mass movement. It's not simply a question of a bunch of NGOs going around and having conferences. We can't. That hasn't worked. We've been doing that for the last few years. I mean, I'm not saying this with any disrespect, because I've been in all these parallel sessions in Copenhagen, Madrid, and so on. But I realize that this has become a ritual. It does not trickle down. It is not going to create the basis for reversing that process, because it stays within small groups of people who travel from one country to the other. We have to broaden our understanding of this crisis, but we also have to bring in many more people who are so that they understand, and that they also are brought in to questioning the legitimacy of those in authority who are responsible for these economic programs, starting in Ontario, starting in Canada, but evidently also looking to other countries where the similar experiences of impoverishment have been applied.
Number two.
But the poor people have no money. All these groups that we have here in Toronto have no finances to fight back. Have you ever thought of that? And are you a columnist for the Star? If you are you going to write about this event? Because I noticed I am a regular at these forums here, and lately I have never seen a TV camera here. So that is another way of discrimination, because they used to have live coverage of events down here for those that can't come here on television, on Channel 10. Well, it's not happening anymore. Is that... Very interesting, isn't it? But then on the other hand, this fellow up there was asking who owns the banks. Well, I have a little thing here from the Metro Network for Social Justice, dated June 30, 1997. And it's called Warning, the Bank Presidents Don't Want You to Read This. And on the second page it says, banks are run by Canada's corporate elite. The directors and shareholders of the major banks include many recognizable names from Canada's corporate elite. Wallace McCain of the McCain Food Family and head of Maple Leaf Food owns 4.32 million of shares in the Royal Bank. Galen Weston of Loblaws and husband of Ontario's Lieutenant Governor owns 4.5 million of shares in the CIBC Bank, and Eric Molson of the Molson Breweries family owns 3.9 million shares in the Bank of Montreal.
30
As
seconds.
A further example, the board of directors of the Royal Bank includes the corporate heads of Alcan Aluminium, McDonald's Restaurants, Nova Corporation, Canadian Pacific, Imperial Oil, and IBM.
I just make one, I think, one comment on the issue of financing of social movements, because that is a crucial question. We know that a lot of non-governmental organizations are dependent on state financing. Either it's state financing or it comes from other sources. It may even come from the World Bank. But I think what is important is that you cannot depend on state financing and then become active in fighting neoliberalism. Okay, you cannot ask the neoliberal agenda to finance the struggle against neoliberalism. And this is not, again, this is not a reflection on the organizations which receive official funding because they don't have any other choice. But I say, ultimately, as this crisis unfolds and as the social conflicts unfold, we will have to rely on our own sources of funding because we can't ask Paul Martin to give us the money to criticize Paul Martin, okay? That is not... So in other words, the question of financing of social movements and of people's organizations is a crucial question which we have to address.
We have 4 minutes left, so please keep your questions short. Number three.
Good evening. Not being an economist, I'm trying to understand some of these terms and ideas so that I can read better the papers and see what's behind. And speculation comes often, and often I hear from other people, oh, but there is good speculation. Now, there is a trick behind that. I'm not sure I see it because I'm not a specialist. So at some point, as an example, I guess the question is there such a good and a bad speculation? And then one of the things that you mentioned in relation to that were the idea of a global market for money, which is different from the money creation resources, industries, schools, and so on, which I suppose you suggested should remain at a national, under a national or local control. So again, this global local idea, is this related to good and bad speculation, or is there something? Is there a way to focus more finely on what is the issue, what is at stake, what's the real problem?
Now, what I tried to explain was how large-scale speculative activities could lead to the destabilization of national currencies. In other words, whether this is good or bad, it's probably good for the people who do it because they make a lot of money out of it. But please understand how it operates. They place a bet on the value of the currency 3 months hence, okay, in the forward exchange market. And at the same time, they create the conditions for that, for the currency to collapse, okay? If you or I speculate, we don't have the power to make we can't make the Canadian dollar tumble. We don't know what's going to happen to it, but they know because they do these operations are done. They're done concurrently. The conditions for the collapse of the currencies precede the assault on these currencies, and ultimately, when the currencies ultimately collapse, they then cash in on billions of dollars.
You want to give us an example?
Now, I'll give you a very specific example. The IMF has been subjected to pressures from Wall Street banks, but more specifically from 290 global financial institutions which operate through a Washington think tank, which is called the Institute of International Finance, to create an environment in which currencies are allowed to slide. I could give you the exact quote of this process, but this pressure, this lobbying was undertaken, in fact, several months before the onslaught of the Asian currency crisis in mid-97. It was transmitted to the IMF. There's a lot of interface between the large financial institutions, which are evidently also creditors and speculators because they operate in currency markets, and the IMF bureaucracy. Now, in turn, there's another process which is which is called Article 4 consultations, which the IMF has been doing, which essentially requires countries to unpeg their currency and to deregulate the movement of money on capital account. And it just so happens that in the year which preceded the Asian currency crisis, there were a whole series of negotiations which were undertaken with Thailand and then with Indonesia. In fact, in Indonesia, it was in the month of May or April that the IMF went in and said, unpeg your currency. Okay? 1 month later, everything tumbled. Okay? And so there's no, I mean, there's a very explicit mechanism involved in this, and the IMF doesn't hide what it's actually doing. It does encourage countries to deregulate the foreign exchange market. And since this process is done in consultation with the large Wall Street banks, they can then position themselves in currency markets, both in anticipation of the collapse, but then provoking the collapse and knowing that the currency is ultimately going to go down, and they get billions and billions of dollars out of these of this type of transaction.
So I think the answer is no. Is this going to be a long question?
No,
short?
No.
Okay, one short question and one short question back there, and I think then we got to go.
Okay, I actually want to make a quick announcement, which includes a question. For those of us that, Michelle, I assume that you, because you concluded your remarks with information that NAFTA was signed by one of three leaders who was a known criminal at the time, that you would be in support of getting us out of NAFTA as Canadians and the sort of thing that David Orchard is advocating in his candidacy. Now, just a second. Also, I want to be sure that, Thomas, you in particular are aware of the fact that David Orchard is speaking at the Empire Club of Canada on the 13th of October. It'll give you a chance to cover that and redeem the reputation of your newspaper, as because your coverage of this campaign has been abysmal.
I'll never be able to redeem the reputation of
okay.
the Star, but...
NAFTA.
Michelle, go ahead.
Well, I think what can I say? I wish success to David Orchard. I think that we are committed to the same things.
Do you think we should get out of NAFTA? That's my question.
No, but I mean, there are various ways of getting out of NAFTA. I think certainly that the issue of Carlos Salinas has to be on our agenda. I have the documents are available on that, incidentally, and they certainly could be used to question the legitimacy of the agreement. Okay, question the legitimacy of an agreement which was signed by a known criminal.
Okay, last question. Last question, real short.
Plug David Orchard. Your earlier comments on global poverty are alarming. The government's central bank decay in Canada is scary. The way the currency speculators contribute to incredible world poverty makes me sick.
I don't mean to be rude, but you really got to be short.
My question is, if we got the G7, the IMF, the UN, all the think tanks together and suggested we put up one currency only in the world, could we not shut down all of the currency speculators?
But that's... Well, the answer is that that is, in fact, where we're going. That is the dominance of essentially two currencies in the world today, which are the European, the euro, but which is really the Deutschmark, which is a European central bank dominated by Germany, by German, and a handful of European banks, and the U.S. dollar, which is dominated by the U.S. Federal Reserve System, of which the large Wall Street banks are the stockholders.
Thank you very much.
That is what we...
I'll make my my concluding remarks are, there's coffee in the lobby. We've got to get out of here. They've got to set up. Thanks a lot.